semi-conscious event. It never occurred to me that our catalog encounter was of any evolutionary consequence whatsoever. Yet evolution consists of an infinitude of trivial, unconscious events, and in the evolution of the potato, my reading of a particular seed catalog on a particular January evening counts as one of them. That May afternoon, the garden suddenly appeared before me in a whole new light. The manifold delights it offered to the eye and nose and tongue no longer quite so innocent or passive. All these plants, which I'd always regarded as the objects of my desire, were also, I realized, subjects, acting on me, getting me to do things for them they couldn't do for themselves. And that's when I had the idea. What would happen if we looked at the world beyond the garden this way? Regarded our place in nature from the same upside-down perspective. This book attempts to do just that, by telling the story of four familiar plants, the apple, the tulip, cannabis, and the potato, and the human desires that link their destinies to our own. Its broader subject is the complex reciprocal relationship between the human and natural world, which I approach from a somewhat unconventional angle. I take seriously the plant's point of view. The four plants whose stories this book tells are what we call domesticated species, a rather one-sided term, that grammar again, that leaves the erroneous impression that we're in charge. We automatically think of domestication as something we do to other species, but it makes just as much sense to think of it as something certain plants and animals have done to us. A clever evolutionary strategy for advancing their own interests. The species that have spent the last 10,000 or so years figuring out how best to feed, heal, clothe, intoxicate, and otherwise delight us have made themselves some of nature's greatest success stories. The surprising thing is, we don't ordinarily regard species like the cow and the potato, the tulip and the dog as nature's more extraordinary creatures. Domesticated species don't command our respect the way their wild cousins often do. Evolution may reward interdependence, but our thinking selves continue to prize self-reliance. The wolf is somehow more impressive to us than the dog. Yet there are 50 million dogs in America today, only 10,000 wolves. So what does the dog know about getting along in this world that its wild ancestor doesn't? The big thing the dog knows about, the subject it has mastered in the 10,000 years it has been evolving at our side, is us. Our needs and desires, our emotions and values, all of which it has folded into its genes as part of a sophisticated strategy for survival. If you could read the genome of the dog like a book, you would learn a great deal about who we are and what makes us tick. We don't ordinarily give plants as much credit as animals, but the same would be true of the genetic books of the apple, the tulip, cannabis, and the potato. We could read volumes about ourselves in their pages, in the ingenious sets of instructions they've developed for turning people into bees. After 10,000 years of coevolution, their genes are rich archives of cultural as well as natural information. The DNA of that tulip there, the ivory one with the petals attenuated like sabers, contains detailed instructions on how best to catch the eye, not of a bee, but of an Ottoman Turk. It has something to tell us about that age's idea of beauty. Likewise, every russet Burbank potato holds within it a treatise about our industrial food chain and our taste for long, perfectly golden French fries. That's because we have spent the last few thousand years remaking these species through artificial selection, transforming a tiny, toxic root node into a fat, nourishing potato and a short, unprepossessing wildflower into a tall, ravishing tulip. What is much less obvious, at least to us, is that these plants have, at the same time, been going about the business of remaking us. I call this book The Botany of Desire because it is as much about the human desires that connect us to these plants as it is about the plants themselves. My premise is that these human desires form a part of natural history in the same way the hummingbird's love of red does, or the ant's taste for the aphid's honeydew. I think of them as the human equivalent of nectar. So, while the book explores the social history of these plants, weaving them into our story, it is at the same time a natural history of the four human desires these plants evolved to stir and gratify. I'm interested not only in how the potato altered the course of European history, or how cannabis helped fire the Romantic Revolution in the West, but also in the way notions in the minds of men and women transformed the appearance, taste, and mental effects of these plants. Through the process of coevolution, human ideas find their way into natural facts. The contours of a tulip's petals, say, or the precise tang of a Jonagold apple. The four desires I explore here are sweetness, broadly defined in the story of the apple, beauty in the tulips, intoxication in the story of cannabis, and control in the story of the potato. Specifically, in the story of a genetically altered potato I grew in my garden to see where the ancient arts of domestication may now be headed. These four plants have something important to teach us about these four desires. That is, about what makes us tick. For instance, I don't think we can begin to understand beauty's gravitational pull without first understanding the flower, since it was the flower that first ushered the idea of beauty into the world the moment, long ago, when floral attraction emerged as an evolutionary strategy. By the same token, intoxication is a human desire we might never have cultivated had it not been for a handful of plants that managed to manufacture chemicals with the precise molecular key needed to unlock the mechanisms in our brain governing pleasure, memory, and maybe even transcendence. Domestication is about a whole lot more than fat tubers and docile sheep. The offspring of the ancient marriage of plants and people are far stranger and more marvelous than we realize. There is a natural history of the human imagination, of beauty, religion, and possibly philosophy too. One of my aims in this book is to shed some light on the part in that history these ordinary plants have played. Plants are so unlike people that it's very difficult for us to appreciate fully their complexity and sophistication. Yet plants have been evolving much, much longer than we have been inventing new strategies for survival and perfecting their designs for so long that to say that one of us is the more advanced really depends on how you define that term, on what advances you value. Naturally, we value abilities such as consciousness, tool-making, and language, if only because these have been the destinations of our own evolutionary journey thus far. Plants have traveled all that distance and then some. They've just traveled in a different direction. Plants are nature's alchemists, expert at transforming water, soil, and sunlight into an array of precious substances, many of them beyond the ability of human beings to conceive, much less manufacture. While we were nailing down consciousness and learning to walk on 2 feet, they were, by the same process of natural selection, inventing photosynthesis, the astonishing trick of converting sunlight into food, and perfecting organic chemistry. As it turns out, many of the plants' discoveries in chemistry and physics have served us well. From plants come chemical compounds that nourish and heal and poison and delight the senses. Others that rouse and put to sleep and intoxicate, and a few with the astounding power to alter consciousness, even to plant dreams in the brains of awake humans. Why would they go to all this trouble? Why should plants bother to devise the recipes for so many complex molecules and then expend the energy needed to manufacture them? One important reason is defense. A great many of the chemicals plants produce are designed, by natural selection, to compel other creatures to leave them alone. Deadly poisons, foul flavors, toxins to confound the minds of predators. But many other of the substances plants make have exactly the opposite effect, drawing other creatures to them by stirring and gratifying their desires. The same great existential fact of plant life explains why plants make chemicals to both repel and attract other species. Immobility. The one big thing plants can't do is move, or, to be more precise, locomote. Plants can't escape the creatures that prey on them. They also can't change location or extend their range without help. And so, about 100 million years ago, plants stumbled on a way, actually a few thousand different ways, of getting animals to carry them, and their genes here and there. This was the evolutionary watershed associated with the advent of the angiosperms, an extraordinary new class of plants that made showy flowers and formed large seeds that other species were induced to disseminate. Plants began evolving burrs that attach to animal fur like Velcro, flowers that seduce honeybees in order to powder their thighs with pollen, and acorns that squirrels obligingly taxi from one forest to another, bury, and then, just often enough, forget to eat. Even evolution evolves. About 10,000 years ago, the world witnessed a second flowering of plant diversity that we would come to call, somewhat self-centeredly, the invention of agriculture. A group of angiosperms refined their basic put-the-animals-to-work strategy to take advantage of one particular animal that had evolved not only to move freely around the earth, but to think and trade complicated thoughts. These plants hit on a remarkably clever strategy: getting us to move and think for them. Now came edible grasses, such as wheat and corn, that incited humans to cut down vast forests to make more room for them. Flowers whose beauty would transfix whole cultures. Plants so compelling and useful and tasty, they would inspire human beings to seed, transport, extol, and even write books about them. This is one of those books. So, am I suggesting that the plants made me do it? Only in the sense that the flower makes the bee pay it a visit. Evolution doesn't depend on will or intention to work. It is almost by definition an unconscious, unwilled process. All it requires are beings compelled, as all plants and animals are, to make more of themselves by whatever means trial and error present. Sometimes an adaptive trait is so clever it appears purposeful. The ant that cultivates its own gardens of edible fungus, for instance, or the pitcher plant that convinces a fly it's a piece of rotting meat. But such traits are clever only in retrospect. Design in nature is but a concatenation of accidents, culled by natural selection until the result is so beautiful or effective as to seem a miracle of purpose. By the same token, we're prone to overestimate our own agency in nature. Many of the activities humans like to think they undertake for their own good purposes, inventing agriculture, outlawing certain plants, writing books in praise of others, are mere contingencies as far as nature is concerned. Our desires are simply more grist for evolution's mill, no different from a change in the weather. A peril for some species, an opportunity for others. Our grammar might teach us to divide the world into active subjects and passive objects, but in a co-evolutionary relationship, every subject is also an object, every object a subject. That's why it makes just as much sense to think of agriculture as something the grasses did to people as a way to conquer the trees. When Charles Darwin was writing The Origin of Species, deciding how best to spring his outlandish idea of natural selection on the world, he settled on a curious rhetorical strategy. Rather than open the book with an account of his new theory, he began with a side subject he judged people, and perhaps English gardeners in particular, would have an easier time getting their heads around. Darwin devoted the first chapter of The Origin of Species to a special case of natural selection called artificial selection, his term for the process by which domesticated species come into the world. Darwin was using the word artificial not as in fake, but as in artifact. a thing reflecting human will. There's nothing fake about a hybrid rose or a butter pear, a cocker spaniel or a show pigeon. These were a few of the domesticated species Darwin wrote about in his opening chapter, demonstrating how, in each case, the species proposes a wealth of variation from which humans then select the traits that will be passed down to future generations. In the special realm of domestication, Darwin explained, human desire, sometimes consciously, sometimes not, plays the same role that blind nature does everywhere else, determining what constitutes fitness and thereby leading, over time, to the emergence of new forms of life. The evolutionary rules are the same, modification by descent. But Darwin understood that they'd be easier to follow in the story of the tea rose than the sea turtle, in the setting of the garden than the Galapagos. In the years since Darwin published The Origin of Species, the crisp conceptual line that divided artificial from natural selection has blurred. Whereas once humankind exerted its will in the relatively small arena of artificial selection, the arena I think of metaphorically as a garden, and nature held sway everywhere else, today the force of our presence is felt everywhere. It has become much harder in the past century to tell where the garden leaves off and pure nature begins. We are shaping the evolutionary weather in ways Darwin could never have foreseen. Indeed, even the weather itself is in some sense an artifact now, its temperatures and storms the reflection of our actions. For a great many species today, fitness means the ability to get along in a world in which humankind has become the most powerful evolutionary force. Artificial selection has become a much more important chapter in natural history as it has moved into the space once ruled exclusively by natural selection. That space, which is the one we often call the wild, was never quite as innocent of our influence as we like to think. The Mohawks and Delawares had left their marks on the Ohio wilderness long before John Chapman, a.k.a. Johnny Appleseed, showed up and began planting apple trees. Yet even the dream of such a space has become hard to sustain in a time of global warming, ozone holes, and technologies that allow us to modify life at the genetic level. One of the wild's last redoubts. Partly by default, partly by design, all of nature is now in the process of being domesticated, of coming or finding itself under the somewhat leaky roof of civilization. Indeed, even the wild now depends on civilization for its survival. Nature's success stories from now on are probably going to look a lot more like the apples than the pandas or white leopards. If those last two species have a future, it will be because of human desire. Strangely enough, their survival now depends on what amounts to a form of artificial selection. This is the world in which we, along with Earth's other creatures, now must make our uncharted way. This book takes place in that world. Consider it a set of dispatches from Darwin's ever-expanding garden of artificial selection. Its main characters are four of that world's success stories. The dogs, cats, and horses of the plant world, these domesticated species are familiar to everyone, so deeply woven into the fabric of our everyday lives that we scarcely think of them as species or parts of nature at all. But why is that? I suspect it's at least partly the fault of the word. Domestic implies that these species have come in or been brought under civilization's roof, which is true enough. Yet the housey metaphor encourages us to think that by doing so they have, like us, somehow left nature, as if nature were something that only happens outside. This is simply another failure of imagination. Nature is not only to be found out there, it is also in here. In the apple and the potato, in the garden and the kitchen, even in the brain of a man beholding the beauty of a tulip or inhaling the smoke from a burning cannabis flower. My wager is that when we can find nature in these sorts of places as readily as we now find it in the wild, we'll have traveled a considerable distance toward understanding our place in the world in the fullness of its complexity and ambiguity. I've chosen the apple, the tulip, cannabis, and the potato for several logical-sounding reasons. One is that they represent four important classes of domesticated plants: a fruit, a flower, a drug plant, and a staple food. Also, having grown these four plants at one time or another in my own garden, I'm on fairly intimate terms with them. But the real reason I chose these plants and not another four is simpler than that. They have great stories to tell. Each of the chapters that follows takes the form of a journey that either starts out, stops by, or ends up in my garden, but along the way ventures far afield, both in space and historical time. To 17th century Amsterdam, where, for a brief, perverse moment, the tulip became more precious than gold. To a corporate campus in St. Louis, where genetic engineers are reinventing the potato. And back to Amsterdam, where another, far less lovely flower has made itself, again, more precious than gold. I also travel to potato farms in Idaho. Follow my species' passion for intoxicating plants down through history and into contemporary neuroscience, and paddle a canoe down a river in central Ohio in search of the real Johnny Appleseed, hoping to render our relationships with these four species in all their complexity. I look at them, by turns, through a variety of lenses: social and natural history, science, journalism, biography, mythology, philosophy, and memoir. These are stories, then, about man and nature. We've been telling ourselves such stories forever as a way of making sense of what we call our relationship to nature. To borrow that curious, revealing phrase, what other species can even be said to have a relationship to nature? For a long time now, the man in these stories has gazed at nature across a gulf of awe or mystery or shame. Even when the tenor of these narratives changes, as it has over time, the gulf remains. There's the old heroic story, where man is at war with nature. The romantic version, where man merges spiritually with nature, usually with some help from the pathetic fallacy. And more recently, the environmental morality tale, in which nature pays man back for his transgressions, usually in the coin of disaster. Three different narratives, at least, yet all of them share a premise we know to be false, but can't seem to shake: that we somehow stand outside, or apart from, nature. This book tells a different kind of story about man and nature. One that aims to put us back in the great reciprocal web that is life on Earth. My hope is that by the time you close its covers, things outside and inside will look a little different, so that when you see an apple tree across a road or a tulip across a table, it won't appear quite so alien, so other. Seeing these plants instead as willing partners in an intimate and reciprocal relationship with us means looking at ourselves a little differently, too. As the objects of other species' designs and desires, as one of the newer bees in Darwin's garden, ingenious, sometimes reckless, and remarkably unselfconscious. Think of this book as that bee's mirror. Chapter 1. Desire, Sweetness. Plant, the Apple. Malus domestica. If you happen to find yourself on the banks of the Ohio River on a particular afternoon in the spring of 1806, somewhere just to the north of Wheeling, West Virginia, say, you would probably have noticed a strange makeshift craft drifting lazily down the river. At the time, this particular stretch of the Ohio, wide and brown and bounded on both sides by steep shoulders of land thick with oaks and hickories, fairly boiled with river traffic, as a ramshackle armada of keelboats and barges ferried settlers from the comparative civilization of Pennsylvania to the wilderness of the Northwest Territory. The peculiar craft you'd have caught sight of that afternoon consisted of a pair of hollowed-out logs that had been lashed together to form a rough catamaran, a sort of canoe plus sidecar. In one of the dugouts lounged the figure of a skinny man of about 30, who may or may not have been wearing a burlap coffee sack for a shirt and a tin pot for a hat. According to the man in Jefferson County who deemed the scene worth recording, the fellow in the canoe appeared to be snoozing without a care in the world, evidently trusting in the river to take him wherever it was he wanted to go. The other hull, his sidecar, was riding low in the water under the weight of a small mountain of seeds that had been carefully blanketed with moss and mud to keep them from drying out in the sun. The fellow snoozing in the canoe was John Chapman, already well known to people in Ohio by his nickname, Johnny Appleseed. He was on his way to Marietta, where the Muskingum River pokes a big hole into the Ohio's northern bank, pointing straight into the heart of the Northwest Territory. Chapman's plan was to plant a tree nursery along one of that river's as-yet-unsettled tributaries, which drain the fertile, thickly forested hills of central Ohio as far north as Mansfield. In all likelihood, Chapman was coming from Allegheny County in western Pennsylvania, to which he returned each year to collect apple seeds, separating them out from the fragrant mounds of pomace that rose by the back door of every cider mill. A single bushel of apple seeds would have been enough to plant more than 300,000 trees. There's no way of telling how many bushels of seed Chapman had in tow that day, but it's safe to say his catamaran was bearing several whole orchards into the wilderness. The image of John Chapman and his heap of apple seeds riding together down the Ohio has stayed with me since I first came across it a few years ago in an out-of-print biography. The scene, for me, has the resonance of myth. A myth about how plants and people learned to use each other, each doing for the other things they could not do for themselves, in the bargain, changing each other and improving their common lot. Henry David Thoreau once wrote that it is remarkable how closely the history of the apple tree is connected with that of man, and much of the American chapter of that story can be teased out of Chapman's story. It's the story of how pioneers like him helped domesticate the frontier by seeding it with old world plants. Exotics, we are apt to call these species today in disparagement, yet without them the American wilderness might never have become a home. What did the apple get in return? A golden age, untold new varieties, and half a world of new habitat. As an emblem of the marriage between people and plants, the design of Chapman's peculiar craft strikes me as just right, implying as it does a relation of parity and reciprocal exchange between its two passengers. More than most of us do, Chapman seems to have had a knack for looking at the world from the plant's point of view. Pomacentrically, you might say. He understood he was working for the apples as much as they were working for him. Perhaps that's why he sometimes likened himself to a bumblebee, and why he would rig up his boat the way he did. Instead of towing his shipment of seeds behind him, Chapman lashed the two hulls together so they would travel down the river side by side. We give ourselves altogether too much credit in our dealings with other species. Even the power over nature that domestication supposedly represents is overstated. It takes two to perform that particular dance, after all, and plenty of plants and animals have elected to sit it out. Try as they might, people have never been able to domesticate the oak tree, whose highly nutritious acorns remain far too bitter for humans to eat. Evidently, the oak has such a satisfactory arrangement with the squirrel, which obligingly forgets where it is buried every fourth acorn or so. Admittedly, the estimate is Beatrix Potter's, that the tree has never needed to enter into any kind of formal arrangement with us. The apple has been far more eager to do business with humans, and perhaps nowhere more so than in America. Like generations of other immigrants before and after, the apple has made itself at home here. In fact, the apple did such a convincing job of this that most of us wrongly assume the plant is a native. Even Ralph Waldo Emerson, who knew a thing or two about natural history, called it the American fruit. Yet there is a sense, a biological, not just metaphorical sense, in which this is, or has become, true. For the apple transformed itself when it came to America. Bringing boatloads of seed onto the frontier, Johnny Appleseed had a lot to do with that process. But so did the apple itself. No mere passenger or dependent. The apple is the hero of its own story. On a summery October afternoon, almost 200 years later, I found myself on the bank of the Ohio River a few miles south of Steubenville, Ohio, at the exact spot where John Chapman is thought to have set foot in the Northwest Territory for the first time. I'd come here to look for him, or at least that's what I thought I was doing. I wanted to find out what I could about the real Johnny Appleseed, the historical figure behind the Disney-fied folk hero, as well as about the apples in whose story Chapman played such a pivotal role. I figured it would be a modest piece of historical detective work. I'd track down the sites of Chapman's orchards, follow his footsteps and canoe wake from western Pennsylvania through central Ohio into Indiana, see if maybe I could find one of the trees he planted. And I did all that, though I'm not sure it got me that much closer to the real John Chapman, a man who by now has been composted beneath a deep sift of myth and legend and wishful thinking. I did find another Johnny Appleseed, however, as well as another apple, both of which had been lost. Actually, the apples and the man have suffered a similar fate in the years since they journeyed down the Ohio together in Chapman's double-hulled canoe. Both then had the tang of strangeness about them, and both have long since been sweetened beyond recognition. Figures of tart wildness, both have been thoroughly domesticated. Chapman transformed into a benign St. Francis of the American frontier, the apple into a blemish-free, plastic-red saccharine orb. Sweetness without dimension is how one pomologist memorably described the Red Delicious. The same might be said of the Johnny Appleseed promulgated by Walt Disney and several generations of American children's book writers. In both cases, a cheap, fake sweetness has been substituted for the real thing, though it would take me a while to figure out exactly what that was. The strong desire that bound them one to the other, and to the country that took them in. Of the man lounging in the two-hulled canoe, Robert Price, his biographer, wrote that he had the thick bark of queerness on him. Indeed. A man with no fixed address his entire adult life, Chapman preferred to spend his nights out of doors. One winter he set up house in a hollowed-out sycamore stump outside Defiance, Ohio, where he operated a pair of nurseries. A vegetarian living on the frontier, he deemed it a cruelty to ride a horse or chop down a tree. He once punished his own foot for squashing a worm by throwing away its shoe. He liked best the company of Indians and children, and rumors trailed him to the effect that he'd once been engaged to marry a 10-year-old girl who'd broken his heart. Price feels compelled to assure his readers that Chapman was not a complete crank. The emphasis is mine. I'd brought a copy of Price's 1954 biography with me to Ohio, and I relied on its maps to retrace Appleseed's annual migration from western Pennsylvania, in search of seeds, to his far-flung properties in Ohio and eventually Indiana. It was Price's account that had led me to the spot where Chapman first crossed the river into Ohio, in a faded, microscopic burg to the south of Steubenville called Brilliant. It had taken me a while to find the landmark mentioned in Price's book, a stream that emptied into the Ohio called George's Run. No one in Brilliant seemed to have heard of it. Eventually, I discovered that the stream has long since been rerouted through a culvert. Today, George's Run flows unseen through a concrete pipe, passes a used car dealership, crosses beneath a savagely potholed street, and finally reemerges from the earth halfway down a steep, littered embankment behind a convenience store. From there, it contributes its meager trickle to the Ohio. The residents of Brilliant had urged Chapman to stay and plant a nursery, but by his lights the place was already overdeveloped. Ever since he'd come west from Longmeadow, Massachusetts in 1797, at the age of 23, Chapman had shied away from settled places, for reasons of both temperament and business. To people in Brilliant, Chapman explained that he preferred to get out ahead of the settlers moving west, and this would become the pattern of his life. Planting a nursery on a tract of wilderness he judged ripe for settlement, and then waiting. By the time the settlers arrived, he'd have apple trees ready to sell them. In time, he would find a local boy to look after his trees, move on, and start the process all over again. By the 1830s, John Chapman was operating a chain of nurseries that reached all the way from western Pennsylvania through central Ohio and into Indiana. It was in Fort Wayne that Chapman died in 1845, wearing the infamous coffee sack, some say, yet leaving an estate that included some 1,200 acres of prime real estate. The barefoot crank died a wealthy man. Sketchy though they were, the biographical facts were enough to make anyone question the saintly Golden Books version of Johnny Appleseed. The child bride? But it was a single botanical fact about the seeds themselves that made me realize that his story had been lost, and probably on purpose. The fact, simply, is this. Apples don't come true from seeds. That is, an apple tree grown from a seed will be a wildling bearing little resemblance to its parent. Anyone who wants edible apples plants grafted trees, for the fruit of seedling apples is almost always inedible. Sour enough, Thoreau once wrote, to set a squirrel's teeth on edge and make a jay scream. Thoreau claimed to like the taste of such apples, but most of his countrymen judged them good for little but hard cider. And hard cider was the fate of most apples grown in America up until Prohibition. Apples were something people drank. The reason people in Brilliant wanted John Chapman to stay and plant a nursery was the same reason he would soon be welcome in every cabin in Ohio. Johnny Appleseed was bringing the gift of alcohol to the frontier. The identification of the apple with notions of health and wholesomeness turns out to be a modern invention, part of a public relations campaign dreamed up by the apple industry in the early 1900s to reposition a fruit that the Women's Christian Temperance Union had declared war on. Carrie Nation's hatchet, it seems, was meant not just for saloon doors, but for chopping down the very apple trees John Chapman had planted by the millions. That hatchet, or at least Prohibition, is probably responsible for the Baudelaireizing of Chapman's story. Johnny Appleseed was revered on the frontier for a great many admirable qualities. He was a philanthropist, a healer, an evangelist of a doctrine veering perilously close to pantheism, a peacemaker with the Indians. Yet as I looked out at the sluggish brown Ohio sliding west, trying to picture the man in rags riding alongside his cargo of cider seeds, I wondered if all the cultural energy spent painting Chapman as a Christian saint wasn't really just an attempt to domesticate a far stranger, more pagan hero. Maybe in Ohio I could catch a glimpse of his former wildness. His and the apples both. Slice an apple through at its equator and you will find five small chambers arrayed in a perfectly symmetrical starburst, a pentagram. Each of the chambers holds a seed, occasionally two, of such a deep, lustrous brown they might have been oiled and polished by a woodworker. Two facts about these seeds are worth noting. First, they contain a small quantity of cyanide, probably a defense the apple evolved to discourage animals from biting into them. They're almost indescribably bitter. The second, more important fact about those seeds concerns their genetic contents, which are likewise full of surprises. Every seed in that apple, not to mention every seed riding down the Ohio alongside John Chapman, contains the genetic instructions for a completely new and different apple tree. One that, if planted, would bear only the most glancing resemblance to its parents. If not for grafting, the ancient technique of cloning trees, every apple in the world would be its own distinct variety, and it would be impossible to keep a good one going beyond the lifespan of that particular tree. In the case of the apple, the fruit nearly always falls far from the tree. The botanical term for this variability is heterozygosity, and while there are many species that share it, our own included, in the apple the tendency is extreme. More than any other single trait, it is the apple's genetic variability, its ineluctable wildness that accounts for its ability to make itself at home in places as different from one another as New England and New Zealand, Kazakhstan and California. Wherever the apple tree goes, its offspring propose so many different variations on what it means to be an apple, at least 5 per apple, several thousand per tree, that a couple of these novelties are almost bound to have whatever qualities it takes to prosper in the tree's adopted home. Exactly where the apple started out from has long been a matter of contention among people who have studied these things, but it appears that the ancestor of Malus domestica, the domesticated apple, is a wild apple that grows in the mountains of Kazakhstan. In some places there, Malus seversi, as it's known to botanists, is the dominant species in the forest, growing to a height of 60 feet and throwing off each fall a cornucopia of odd, apple-like fruits ranging in size from marbles to softballs, in color from yellow and green to red and purple. I've tried to imagine what May in such a forest must look and smell like, or October, with the forest floor a nubby carpet of reds and golds and greens. The silk route traverses some of these forests, and it seems likely that travelers passing through would have picked the biggest and tastiest of these fruits to take with them on their journey west. Along the way, seeds were dropped, wildlings sprouted, and Malus hybridized freely with related species, such as the European crab apples, eventually producing millions of novel apple types all through Asia and Europe. Most of these would have yielded unpalatable fruit, though even these trees would have been worth growing for cider or forage. True domestication had to await the invention of grafting by the Chinese. Sometime in the 2nd millennium BC, the Chinese discovered that a slip of wood cut from a desirable tree could be notched into the trunk of another tree. Once this graft took, the fruit produced on new wood growing out from that juncture would share the characteristics of its more desirable parent. This technique is what eventually allowed the Greeks and Romans to select and propagate the choicest specimens. At this point, the apple seems to have settled down for a while. According to Pliny, the Romans cultivated 23 different varieties of apples, some of which they took with them to England. The tiny oblate lady apple, which still shows up in markets at Christmas time, is thought to be one of these. As Thoreau suggested in an 1862 essay in praise of wild apples, this most civilized of trees followed the westward course of empire, from the ancient world to Europe and then on to America with the early settlers. Much like the Puritans, who regarded their crossing to America as a kind of baptism or rebirth, the apple couldn't cross the Atlantic without changing its identity, a fact that encouraged generations of Americans to hear echoes of their own story in the story of this fruit. The apple in America became a parable. The earliest immigrants to America had brought grafted old world apple trees with them, but in general these trees fared poorly in their new home. Harsh winters killed off many of them outright. The fruit of others was nipped in the bud by late spring frosts unknown in England. But the colonists also planted seeds, often saved from apples eaten during their Atlantic passage, and these seedling trees, called pippins, eventually prospered, especially after the colonists imported honeybees to improve pollination, which had been spotty at first. Ben Franklin reported that by 1781, the fame of the Newtown pippin, a homegrown apple discovered in a Flushing, New York cider orchard, had already spread to Europe. In effect, the apple, like the settlers themselves, had to forsake its former domestic life and return to the wild before it could be reborn as an American. as Newtown Pippins and Baldwins, Golden Russets and Jonathans. This is what the seeds on John Chapman's boat were doing. It may also be what Chapman was doing. By reverting to wild ways, to sexual reproduction, that is, and going to seed, the apple was able to reach down into its vast store of genes, accumulated over the course of its travels through Asia and Europe, and discover the precise combination of traits required to survive in the New World. The apple probably also found some of what it needed by hybridizing with the wild American crabs, which are the only Native American apple trees. Thanks to the species' inherent prodigality, coupled with the work of individuals like John Chapman, in a remarkably short period of time, the New World had its own apples, adapted to the soil and climate and day length of North America. Apples that were as distinct from the old European stock as the Americans themselves. From Brilliant, I followed the course of the Ohio down toward Marietta. Moving south, the landscape begins to relax, the steep, rocky hillsides that leap up from the river near Wheeling reclining into rich-looking farmland. It was the first week of October, a Sunday, and many of the cornfields had been only partially shaved, presenting a cartoon of work interrupted. In some fields, the tall, dun corn had been cut away to reveal an old-time oil derrick. The first oil fields in America were found just outside Marietta. A farmer digging his well would notice bubbles of natural gas percolating through the water, the unmistakable scent of hitting it big. Before then, discovering a great apple tree in one's cider orchard had been the ticket. Most of the oil rigs are stilled and rusted, but now and then I spotted one still pumping lustily away as if the year were 1925. In Marietta, I stopped in at the Campus Martius Museum, a small brick history museum devoted to Ohio's pioneer days, when Marietta served as the gateway to the Northwest Territory. The first thing a visitor encounters is a sprawling tabletop diorama showing what the area looked like in 1788. That was the year a Revolutionary War hero named Rufus Putnam, who had won a charter for his Ohio company from the Continental Congress, arrived here with a small party of men. Their families would follow a few months later, after the men had constructed the small, walled settlement that formerly stood on this spot. 18th-century maps on the walls trace an intricately ramifying tree of rivers and streams, reaching north from the Muskingum's trunk, connecting the dots of a scatter of place names that quickly thins to blankness. The maps force you to think of Ohio in an unaccustomed way, no longer as a middle, but as a beginning. An edge. That, of course, was what this place was in 1801, when Chapman first stood here. America's threshold place, the cliff of everything unknown and yet to be. Unless, of course, you happen to be a Delaware or a Wyandotte, for whom the very notion of wilderness was an error or a lie. But for a white American in 1801, Marietta was the last stop before stepping over the edge. In 1801, one of the things you could buy in Marietta before heading into the interior was apple trees. Soon after his arrival, Rufus Putnam had himself planted a nursery on the opposite bank of the Ohio, so that he might sell trees to the pioneers passing through. What was surprising about this was that the apples Putnam sold were not grown from seeds. They were grafted trees. In fact, his nursery offered a selection of the well-known eastern varieties, the Roxbury Russets, Newtown Pippins, and early Chandlers that had already made their names in colonial New England. What this meant, of course, was that John Chapman's apples were neither the first in Ohio, nor by any stretch the best, for his were seedling trees exclusively. Chapman, somewhat perversely, would have nothing to do with grafted trees. They can improve the apple in that way, he's supposed to have said, but that is only a device of man, and it is wicked to cut up trees that way. The correct method is to select good seeds and plant them in good ground, and God only can improve the apple. So what exactly was unique about Chapman's operation, and why did it succeed? Apart from his almost fanatical devotion to apples planted from seed, his business was distinguished by its portability. His willingness to pack up and move his apple tree operation to keep pace with the ever-shifting frontier. Like a shrewd real estate developer, which is one way to describe him, Chapman had a sixth sense for exactly where the next wave of development was about to break. There, he would go and plant his seeds on a tract of waterfront land, sometimes paid for, sometimes not, confident in the expectation that a few years hence, a market for his trees would appear at his doorstep. By the time the settlers came, he'd have 2 to 3 year old trees ready for sale at 6.5 cents apiece. Chapman was evidently the only apple man on the American frontier pursuing such a strategy. It would have large consequences for both the frontier and the apple. If a man had the temperament for it and didn't care about starting a family or putting down roots, selling apple trees along the shifting edge of the frontier was not a bad little business. Apples were precious on the frontier, and Chapman could be sure of a strong demand for his seedlings, even if most of them would yield nothing but spitters. He was selling, cheaply, something everybody wanted. Something, in fact, everybody in Ohio needed by law. A land grant in the Northwest Territory specifically required a settler to set out at least 50 apple or pear trees as a condition of his deed. The purpose of the rule was to dampen real estate speculation by encouraging homesteaders to put down roots. Since a standard apple tree normally took 10 years to fruit, an orchard was a mark of lasting settlement. An orchard is also an idealized or domesticated version of a forest, and the transformation of a shadowy tract of wilderness into a tidy geometry of apple trees offered a visible, even stirring proof that a pioneer had mastered the primordial forest. Compared to the awesome majesty of the old-growth trees the early settlers encountered, the modesty of an apple tree, the way it obligingly takes on the forms we give it, holding out its fruit and flowers so near to hand, must have been a tremendous comfort on the frontier. That's one reason planting an orchard became one of the earliest ceremonies of settlement on the American frontier. The other was the apples themselves. It takes a leap of the historical imagination to appreciate just how much the apple meant to people living 200 years ago. By comparison, the apple in our eye is a fairly inconsequential thing. A popular fruit, second only to the banana, but nothing we can't imagine living without. It is much harder for us to imagine living without the experience of sweetness, however, and sweetness, in the widest, oldest sense, is what the apple offered an American in Chapman's time, the desire it helped gratify. Sugar was a rarity in 18th century America. Even after cane plantations were established in the Caribbean, it remained a luxury good beyond the reach of most Americans. Later on, cane sugar became so closely identified with the slave trade that many Americans avoided buying it on principle. Before the English arrived, and for some time after, there were no honeybees in North America, therefore no honey to speak of. For a sweetener, Indians in the North had relied on maple sugar instead. It wasn't until late in the 19th century that sugar became plentiful and cheap enough to enter the lives of very many Americans, and most of them lived on the eastern seaboard. Before then, the sensation of sweetness in the lives of most people came chiefly from the flesh of fruit. And in America, that usually meant the apple. Sweetness is a desire that starts on the tongue with the sense of taste, but it doesn't end there. Or at least it didn't end there, back when the experience of sweetness was so special that the word served as a metaphor for a certain kind of perfection. When writers like Jonathan Swift and Matthew Arnold used the expression sweetness and light to name their highest ideal, Swift called them the two noblest of things, Arnold the ultimate aim of civilization, they were drawing on a sense of the word sweetness going back to classical times. A sense that has largely been lost to us. The best land was said to be sweet. So were the most pleasing sounds, the most persuasive talk, the loveliest views, the most refined people, and the choicest part of any whole, as when Shakespeare calls spring the sweet of the year. Lent by the tongue to all the other sense organs, sweet, in the somewhat archaic definition of the Oxford English Dictionary, is that which affords enjoyment or gratifies desire. Like a shimmering equal sign, the word sweetness denoted a reality commensurate with human desire. It stood for fulfillment. Since then, sweetness has lost much of its power and become slightly, well, saccharine. Who now would think of sweetness as a noble quality? At some point during the 19th century, a hint of insincerity began to trail the word through literature, and in our time it's usually shadowed by either irony or sentimentality. Overuse probably helped to cheapen the word's power on the tongue, but I think the advent of cheap sugar in Europe, and perhaps especially cane sugar produced by slaves, is what did the most to discount sweetness, both as an experience and as a metaphor. The final insult came with the invention of synthetic sweeteners. Both the experience and the metaphor seemed to me worth recovering, if for no other reason than to appreciate the apple's former power. Start with the taste. Imagine a moment when the sensation of honey or sugar on the tongue was an astonishment, a kind of intoxication. The closest I've ever come to recovering such a sense of sweetness was secondhand, though it left a powerful impression on me even so. I'm thinking of my son's first experience of sugar, the icing on the cake at his first birthday. I have only the testimony of Isaac's face to go by, that and his fierceness to repeat the experience, but it was plain that his first encounter with sugar had intoxicated him. Was, in fact, an ecstasy in the literal sense of that word. That is, he was beside himself with the pleasure of it, no longer here with me in space and time in quite the same way he had been just a moment before. Between bites, Isaac gazed up at me in amazement. He was on my lap, and I was delivering the ambrosial forkfuls to his gaping mouth, as if to exclaim, "Your world contains this? From this day forward, I shall dedicate my life to it," which he basically has done. And I remember thinking, this is no minor desire, and then wondered, could it be that sweetness is the prototype of all desire? Anthropologists have found that cultures vary enormously in their liking for bitter, sour, and salty flavors, but a taste for sweetness appears to be universal. This goes for many animals, too, which shouldn't be surprising, since sugar is the form in which nature stores food energy. As with most mammals, our first experience of sweetness comes with our mother's milk. It could be that we acquire a taste for it at the breast, or we may be born with an instinct for sweet things that makes us desire mother's milk. Either way, sweetness has proved to be a force in evolution. By encasing their seeds in sugary and nutritious flesh, fruiting plants, such as the apple, hit on an ingenious way of exploiting the mammalian sweet tooth. In exchange for fructose, the animals provide the seeds with transportation, allowing the plant to expand its range. As parties to this grand co-evolutionary bargain, animals with the strongest predilection for sweetness and plants offering the biggest, sweetest fruits prospered together and multiplied, evolving into the species we see and are today. As a precaution, the plants took certain steps to protect their seeds from the avidity of their partners. They held off on developing sweetness and color until the seeds had matured completely. Before then, fruits tend to be inconspicuously green and unpalatable. And in some cases, like the apples, the plants developed poisons in their seeds to ensure that only the sweet flesh is consumed. Desire, then, is built into the very nature and purpose of fruit, and so, quite often, is a kind of taboo. The vegetable kingdom's lack of glamour by comparison, whoever heard of a forbidden vegetable, can be laid to the fact that a vegetable's reproductive strategy doesn't turn on turning animals on. The blandishments of sugar are what got the apple out of the Kazakh forests, across Europe, to the shores of North America, and eventually into John Chapman's canoe. But the appeal of apples to humans, and perhaps especially to American humans, probably owes to their figurative as well as literal sweetness. The earliest settlers lighting out from places like Marietta wanted apple trees nearby because they were one of the comforts of home. Since the time of the New England Puritans, apples have symbolized and contributed to a settled and productive landscape. In the eyes of a European, fruit trees were part and parcel of a